Before I answer your question, Mr. Goodman, about the flag of the surrender of Jerusalem, which really is quite a story, perhaps I'd better go back a bit and explain how it all came about. In 1917, President Wilson, members of his cabinet, urged me to go abroad and gather material on the various Allied campaigns, take cameramen with me, and come back and, if possible, do something to help arouse the American people, get them to take an interest in the war. This was something that was rather desperately needed at that time from the standpoint of President Wilson. He had been in office for one term, and in running for re-election, his principal plank was that he was not going to get the American people into the First World War. And then, lo and behold, not long after he had been re-elected, why, events sort of closed in on America in such a way that there we were involved in the war. And President Wilson and members of his cabinet felt that the American people were not just ready for it. So, for one reason or another, I was a very young fellow, but still, they happened to know me, and I'd been on the platform, done a lot of speaking and so on. Also, I was on the faculty at Princeton University, and Mr. Wilson, of course, had been the president at Princeton before I arrived there. They urged me to go abroad, take cameramen with me. My principal cameraman was a chap named Harry Chase, and we were on the Italian front shortly after the great disaster at Capretto, and things had quieted down on the Italian front. One day I came in to Venice. The city was deserted. The people had all fled because it looked as though Venice was going to fall. Of course, it didn't. And on a sandbag in front of St. Mark's Cathedral, I saw a bulletin. They put them there for the benefit of Italian naval officers, mainly, who were going in and out of Venice at that time. And this bulletin stated that a new commander-in-chief had just been sent out to the Near East, and that his name was Allenby. Although I knew almost nothing about events prior to Allenby's arrival in the East, I did know a little bit about him. I knew something of his cavalry record, how extremely successful he had been in the Boer War. And I had even heard about the success he had had on the Western Front at the retreat at Mons, and that apparently what he had done at the retreat at Mons had saved the lives of large numbers of British soldiers. At any rate, I figured that if Allenby was being sent out to the East, that it probably meant that something exciting was going to happen. And I assumed that that exciting thing was an attempt to drive the Turks out of the Holy Land and possibly force the Turks to capitulate. So I sent a long message to the British Foreign Office in London from the Italian front. In it, I said that I wanted to go out and join the British forces in the Near East, and I explained why, that I was over there gathering material to... Come on in, sit down. I explained that I was over there gathering material to take back, hoping to interest the American people in the war, arouse them a little bit. That was my job. And also I quoted whatever credentials I had, letters from the President and the Secretary of War and the Secretary of the Navy and so on, and from Mr. Creel, who was head of the Department of Information in Washington.
The U.S. was in the war by then, wasn't it?
Yes, we were in the war. I'd gone over about the same time as General Pershing, and I'd been on the Western Front for a time, and I'd gone down to the Italian Front. And I got a message very quickly from the British ambassador in Rome, whose name was Sir Reynold Rodd, asking me to come to Rome as soon as possible. And when I got there, he told me there was a British destroyer. Actually, it was a courier vessel, a fast vessel of the destroyer type, at Taranto. And it would take me across the Mediterranean and my cameraman, Harry Chase. Well, we got chased by submarines, as a matter of fact. We got chased into the harbor at Valletta at Malta, and we were trapped at Malta for about a week. But then we got on out to Alexandria. And when we got to Egypt, a rather odd thing happened. They kept us cooling our heels at Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo for about 10 days. And it wasn't until after the war was over that I found out why. And the reason was the Foreign Office had not advised Allenby that we were coming. Allenby was short on transportation. That was a factor. But I think another factor, which was perhaps even more important, was he didn't want any representatives of any foreign governments with his army. He knew that if he accepted a representative from America, he'd have to take them from all the other Allied countries because of the great interest that people generally had in the Holy Land and the holy places and so on. He figured that he'd be overwhelmed with requests. So he shut down completely. And covering the war in Palestine, and this is astounding, you know, to think that such a thing could have been possible in the light of how such matters were conducted in the Second World War, when there were hundreds, in fact thousands, of correspondents swarming all over the place, everywhere. In the Palestine campaign, there were just two. One represented all the London and British newspapers. They pooled the matter and selected a man from the Daily Telegraph named Massey, who later became editor of the Daily Telegraph. And the other was the representative of Reuters, Fergus Ferguson. No one else. Well, Allenby had this discussion by cable with London, wanting to know who the hell was running the Palestine campaign. He was a pretty stormy personality. And when he was finally satisfied that London didn't intend to try and run the show for him, oh, then he relented and was very gracious and said, come along, up you go to the front. And so he turned me over to a British pilot who had just escaped from the Western Front, whose name was A.J. Evans. He, at that time, I was told, was Britain's most famous cricket star. He had been shot down on the Western Front. And during the First World War, if a man was shot down on one front, he was never sent back into action on that if he escaped from prison. He was never sent back into action on that front for fear that he'd be shot. So they sent him out to the east. And I flew with him in a small plane, like a kite it was, across the Sinai Desert and on up to Palestine. A few days after we arrived, Evans was shot down again. And when the war ended, he had escaped from prison once more and was dressed as a woman on his way to Russia. He later wrote a famous book that was a bestseller called The Escaping Club. Well, so much for that. Anyhow, there I was with Allenby's army. And actually, my tent mates were Fergus Ferguson and Massey of the Daily Telegraph.
What was Massey's first name? Do you know?
William T. Massey, I believe.
Where did you join the army? In Beersheba, or?
No. By that time, they had pushed on beyond Gaza and Beersheba, and I joined them at in the plain of Esdraelon at Rishon LeZion, which had been the headquarters for Napoleon's army. And that's where we had our camp. Yes. And then I was with Allenby's army almost until the end of the campaign. Although I did detour, I happened to be lucky enough to accidentally run into Lawrence on one of the narrow streets in Jerusalem one day, and he was wearing Arab costume, and it was perfectly obvious to me that he was not an Arab. So I got in touch with the then governor of Jerusalem. The Tommies called him Pontius Pilate. His name was Sir Ronald Storrs, and I asked Storrs who this blonde chap was, this little fellow wearing Arab costume, and he introduced me to Lawrence. And it was actually Storrs who created the name for him that became famous afterward, and of course was always attributed to me. He said, I want you to meet the uncrowned king of Arabia. And he was just pulling Lawrence's leg because he and Lawrence were pals. They'd been at Oxford together and...
Storrs was quite his senior, wasn't he?
Storrs, yes.
Storrs was a colonel, perhaps, at the time?
He was a colonel at the time.
Lawrence was what?
Well, Lawrence was a lieutenant colonel.
Oh, was he?
Yes, at that time. Yes.
I thought he was much.
No, no. He was a lieutenant colonel by then. So he introduced me, and we got acquainted. And I spent... he had been called in from the desert by Allenby to be decorated at the time that the Duke of Connaught came out to represent the king, to present decorations following the fall of Jerusalem, which they did on a grand scale in front of the Tower of David near the Jaffa Gate in the Great Wall. And Lawrence was there for that occasion. He was there for a number of days for discussions with Allenby also, of course. And during all of his spare time, well, I tried to usurp it, and I spent it with him. And I wanted to go to Arabia and join him, and he said it was impossible. So he had nothing to do with my getting to Arabia at all. I mean, directly, indirectly, of course he did, because it was my interest in this remarkable man. I saw very quickly that he was something really phenomenal. And so I wanted to get to Arabia, but he said I couldn't do it because he was going back through the lines and that I couldn't very easily disguise myself. Spoke no Arabic, he spoke some. Anyhow, so I forgot about it and thought, well, that's just one of those things that didn't come off. But I had a stroke of extraordinary good luck. A week or so after that, Allenby invited me to come alone and have lunch with him and the Duke of Connaught because I was the only American out there. That was undoubtedly the sole reason. I, a youngster, why would he invite me to come and join him and the Duke?
And the other two correspondents weren't invited?
No, one else was invited. He just invited me. It was actually, I think the Duke was responsible for it. The Duke had been Governor General of Canada, and I was wearing an American uniform, which in those days included a hat that was exactly the same as the hat worn by the Royal Mounted Police.
Doughboy hat.
Yeah, it's here. You see it. I'm wearing it over here in this picture on the wall. And the Duke saw this, and it sort of was a blot on the scenery. It was the only hat of its kind in that part of the world. And he asked Allenby, who under the sun can that be? Thinking that I might be a mounted policeman, maybe from Canada or something. So Allenby invited me. It reminded Allenby of the fact that I was there, you see. And he thought that since I was the only American, he'd invite me to lunch. Well, I had the commander-in-chief somewhat at my mercy because he was my host under very unusual circumstances. So I asked him who this man was that I had been with, Lawrence. Of course, I by then knew a little about Lawrence, but he was being kept pretty much under wraps because the British were trying to make it appear that the Arabian campaign was strictly Arabian, not British. And so they were not playing up the fact that there were some Britishers with the Arabian forces and that they were playing a tremendous role in that campaign. That was being played down. But when I asked Allenby about Lawrence, he said that the campaign in Arabia had reached the point, and the campaign in Palestine had reached the point where it was no longer to keep it a secret necessary. And he said, if I wanted to go down and join Lawrence in Arabia, okay, go ahead. Well, I got out of Palestine as fast as I could, back by way of Egypt, and then up the Nile to the Sudan, then across the Sudan to the coast to Port Sudan, and then I got on a tramp that was carrying supplies for the Arabian army, and went across the Red Sea to the Arabian coast, and then went up the coast and joined Lawrence. To his amazement, there I was. People have sometimes have said that Lawrence was responsible for my being there and that he wanted me to be there to give publicity to his campaign and all that, which was not true at all. He didn't care a hoot. He couldn't have cared less. Later on, it was another matter, because then something came up at the peace conference which made it of some importance to him. To have a fellow like me telling about the Arabian campaign and emphasizing the fact that it had played a role in ending the war. Well, anyhow, so I was with Lawrence, and I spent some time with Lawrence, and then I went back to Egypt because I wanted to spend a little time. It looked as though the war might not last as long as we had originally thought it might last, and I wanted to get back to the Western Front to be with the American troops for a time. I didn't realize what a dramatic story the Arabian campaign was. To some extent I did, but not really. It wasn't until years afterward that I realized what a tremendous story I had. For instance, after the First World War, our most famous war correspondent, or correspondent rather, in Europe, was a man named Walter Durante, who was an Englishman with one leg, a Cambridge Don. He was with the New York Times. Walter Duranty in one of his books said that I probably had the number one scoop of all time in the history of journalism because I was the only person who had a war all to myself. No one else, the only observer with the Arabian campaign, which is an incredible thing. Actually, I almost had the Palestine campaign to myself because Massey was the kind of man who was very meticulous about details, but not about the color of the campaign. Ferguson, born in Constantinople, had lived so close to the scene all his life that the color of it...
It's no longer exotic.
Yes, it wasn't exotic to him. And here I was, a fellow who had arrived out of the mountains of Colorado, hadn't been away from a mining camp in Colorado very long, and everything that I saw in the East was glamorous and spectacular and exotic and exciting and full of adventure. So I virtually had the two campaigns to myself. But when I got back to the Western Front, the war ended pretty quickly. So there was no reason for my hurrying home to America. The reason for my job had vanished. So I decided to stay in Europe a little longer, and I was the first person to get inside Central Europe and bring back the story of the German Revolution. That is, a companion I had with me named Webb Waldron, who was the European editor of Collier's at the time. He and I made this thing together, and we went inside, and came back to America, made a report to President Wilson and his people, who had arrived at the Versailles Peace Conference by then, by the time we got out of Germany, and then came on home. Well, here I was. The war was over. No one cared a hoot about it, really. After a war is over, that's the one thing people want to forget. And they want to forget it for a number of years. And the cycle doesn't come back for a number of years, as a rule. However, a lot of money had been spent on what Chase and I had been doing, and it had all been put up privately, not by the government. It was, no, it was put up by private individuals in Chicago. 15 Chicago tycoons backed me on this thing.
At the behest of the president.
Well, yes, that's right. Anyhow, I had all this material. What was I going to do with it? So I decided to take a chance and put it on anyhow. Well, people didn't care anything at all about the story I told of the American campaign in France. That was over. They didn't care anything about the Italian campaign. They didn't care anything about the war in the Balkans, and I had a show on that. They did care about the German Revolution, and I had a show on that because I brought films back from Central Europe. I didn't take my cameraman with me, but I got German cameramen when I was in there. And also I bought film from German companies that had made film of the German Revolution. I had the first material on the Revolution. People were interested in that when I told those stories. And they were interested in my story of the fall of Jerusalem, and they were tremendously interested in the story I told of Lawrence of Arabia, more particularly in the story of the fall of Jerusalem at that time, because they hadn't heard anything about it, really.
Where were you, sir, the day...
Well, anyhow, let me go on and finish the thing. I launched my series here in New York City, and I did it in a place called the Century Theater, which has been torn down now. It was a white elephant. It was the largest theater in New York. I was one of two ever to have a success in the Century Theater, they told me. The other was Lily Brayton and Oscar Ashe and Choo Chin Chow, which came over here from England after the First World War, and my thing. Well, at the end of a couple of weeks at the Century Theater, some other show was coming in. Someone else had a lease on it, so I had to move. And after a great war, there's always a revival of interest in the theater. Every theater was booming in New York. I couldn't get a theater. The only thing available was Madison Square Garden, a huge place. So we took Madison Square Garden. And I had great crowds that came. By then, I had given up all my shows, excepting the German Revolution, the story of the Palestine campaign, and the story of Lawrence of Arabia. I had separate ones on each one. And on my last night, an extraordinary thing happened. Well, at any rate, extraordinary so far as I'm concerned. A British impresario came to hear me, and if he hadn't come on that last night, the things that happened afterward might never have happened at all, because I'd never thought of going to London with my shows. He came and was stunned.
To the Century, yeah.
No, he came to Madison Square Garden. He came and was stunned to hear me, an American, telling a story that he, a Britisher, had never even heard and knew almost nothing about. So he came and asked me if I'd be willing to put on my show about the Palestine campaign and the Arabian campaign, not the German Revolution, in London. And I laughed at him and told him I couldn't go because I'd booked a tour of America. I'd personally put deposits on practically all the big white elephant auditoriums from coast to coast. And I figured I couldn't afford to do anything but go ahead with my plan. But that was in a day when there were no public address systems. It was before the electronic era. It was in a day before there were any air conditioning systems. And the theaters of America all closed down during the months of July and August. And I was going to take that time off for a holiday. And I told him that if he could get to London and arrange for me to appear during that period in London, then I would go under two conditions. One, if he'd put me on in the most famous theater in the English-speaking world. And second, if he'd get an invitation from the king. And I was just pulling his leg because I didn't expect him to do either one. The first thing he asked me was what I thought was the most famous theater in the English-speaking world. And I said, well, since you asked me the question, I think my answer would be there are two of them. One would be the Royal Opera House at Covent Garden. The other would be Drury Lane, where Irving and so many other of the great figures had appeared. And I said, either Drury Lane or the Royal Opera House. Well, to my utter amazement, he went to England, got the Royal Opera House, made a deal with Beecham, who hadn't been knighted at that time, but who had his opera company. And he made a deal with Beecham, who had the lease on the opera house, and sent me word to come. And he asked me if I would combine the two shows, the Palestine and Arabian, which I did, with an intermission in between. He said the people like to go out in the middle of a show and have coffee and refreshments and drinks and so on, and please do that. So I did. Well, Burton, an Englishman, was responsible for my going to London.
That was the impresario.
He was the impresario. Percy Burton was his name. Later on, I wrote his biography, in fact. He had handled Sir Henry Irving, Sarah Bernhardt, Eleanor Duzet, Sir Johnson Forbes Robertson, Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree. His specialty was handling individuals. And, of course, it was a natural for him to handle this thing of mine. And he did a terrific job. On the opening night, he filled the house, the first white tie tails audience that London had had in 4 years. It was my opening at the Royal Opera House. And he had people like Lady Cunard and others give box parties and so on. And, well, the newspapers of London did something the next day that I was told was without precedent. Instead of reviewing my show in the theatrical columns, the theatrical page, they reviewed it on the equivalent of page one. In those days, of course, the Times had a different format, you know, and I think the others did as well. Anyhow, in no time at all, we were sold out all the time. And
this is 1920-ish?
1919. In fact, scalpers got control of the seats and were selling them at a guinea a piece, and people would sit all day outside the Royal Opera House on camp stools to get in at night up into the top of the gallery, you know. And I didn't realize what an impact this was having. I was too young and too naive to really realize what was happening. The royal family came, people like Bernard Shaw, Rudyard Kipling.
This was Palestine and Alan.
Combined, yes. Half of it was the Palestine campaign. I called it with Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia. That was the title of the show. And even Clement...
Lectures?
No, no lectures.
Film.
Film, but I talked with it, but no lecture. It was a show. I never used the word lecture.
No.
And I avoided the word travelogue a little later, too. There are certain words that will kill your audience and cut you off. Those words are lecture, travelogue, and documentary.
Yes.
If you, anytime you use one of those, you reduce your audience by a large percentage. So I didn't use anything. I used an orchestra also. And I used the first sound effects that were ever used on the screen, so far as I know.
Lawrence didn't accompany you in any of these?
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness, no. He was a modest fellow who wouldn't do that kind of thing at all. No.
Did you want him?
No, why? I never thought of it.
No.
Never occurred to me. I was telling a story. I had the story to tell. Why should I bother with having anybody there with me? I had I put on the first live prologue that was ever put on in connection with an entertainment. I took a scene from one of Sir Thomas Beecham's operas, Joseph and His Brethren, Moonlight on the Nile scene, and I had a dancer come in and do a dance of the Seven Veils, and I had an Irish tenor sing the Mohammedan Call to Prayer off stage. And that was preceded by the Welsh Guards Band, 60 pieces, that played for 20 minutes before even the prologue. And then from the prologue, it went straight into me without any introduction, no ladies and gentlemen or anything like that at all, straight into the show. which I've never called my things anything but the title of whatever it is, with Ellen Bin Palestine or with Lawrence in Arabia, or in my Cinerama days. I don't know whether you ever saw any of the big Cinerama shows or not. Just the name of the show. I always avoided things like documentary and travelogue and lecture. Anyhow, I ran, and over 1 million people came to hear me in London. And Mr. Burton came around to me after a couple of months and said, what would you like to have? The British people are grateful to you for telling this story of their campaigns, which no one else had told, and they want to do something. And I said, what? And they said, well, you can get an honor if you want it from the king. How about a big public luncheon or banquet? And I said to him, what will help you the most? I said, it doesn't make any difference to me. What will help you? By then, I had canceled my American tour and was staying on. It cost me $30,000, $40,000 to send my cable to America because I lost all my deposits. But I saw by then that this was something incredible that had happened to me over in London, and that I'd better stay and go on with it. Well, when he came and asked me about this, I told him to go ahead and use his own judgment. He said the thing that would help him the most would be a public affair, because he could get more publicity out of that than he could out if I was given a decoration or an honor of some kind. So the press barons gave a banquet for me in a magnificent ballroom. I think it was banquet room. I think it was on top of the Criterion in Piccadilly in those days. It was the number one sort of banquet place in London. And Lord Burnham, who then owned the Daily Telegraph, presided, and the principal speaker was Astor. That was Major Astor, who had a wooden leg, whom you may never have heard of. But you see, there were two Astors who really were prominent. One was Lord Astor, and Lady Astor was his wife in Parliament, and Lord Astor was in the House of Lords. The other one was Major Astor, who owned and controlled the Times. And the Astors that you are aware of course, are another generation, a later generation. Well, anyhow, they gave this big banquet and so on. And then the Prime Minister came, Lloyd George, and part of his cabinet came. And the night he came, he was given a vote of no confidence in the House of Parliament, because they said in Parliament that instead of being up listening to me, he should be minding his own job down at Westminster. And you can imagine the publicity that gave me, you know, just marvelous. He brought Churchill with him, incidentally. Yes, Churchill then was Home Secretary. Anyhow, it was an extraordinary experience that I had. Well, as a result of what I did, you may have run out of tape by now. As a result of the success I had, various other people thought that they would try and imitate me. Shackleton came back from the Antarctic and tried to hire my cameraman and projection man away from me because he saw what a rather unusual show I had.
Harry Chase as well.
Yes, he tried to hire Chase away from me because Shackleton then was going to put on the story of his Antarctic adventures, which of course was a thrilling one, the endurance in the ice and all that, you know. Well, and then Major Arthur Radcliffe Dugmore, who was a famous British artist and explorer from Africa, had a show that he wanted to put on. And Captain John B. L. Noel, who was a member of the first Mount Everest expedition, wanted to put on a show. And there were a lot of people who got into the act as a result of this phenomenal success I had had. And one of the men who tried to do something was a Canadian colonel. I don't remember his name.